You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello there and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith and today I'm very pleased indeed to be bringing you an interview with the truly unique comedian and one half of the Bugle podcast. Please be upstanding for the grand high poobah of Bullshitistan, a man who tortures language until it weeps and begs for mercy. He shows no mercy. The pun grinder general himself, Mr. Andy Zaltzman. I'm in your shed, which is presumably where you write. This is the
hub of, you know, Zaltzman PLC. I'm not PLC. One day. The great media empire that is Andy Zaltzman is based in this shed.
And it's more than just a shed as well. I think to call it just a shed is sort of to do it a disservice.
I believe what's technically known as a garden office.
Is that right? Okay. Yeah.
So it makes me feel like when I walk in it, it's an office. I'm, you know, at work, which is very hard to think as a comedian because your entire kind of working life is dependent on you not thinking of it as a job, I think. So it's kind of maintaining the necessary levels of juvenility and lack of seriousness to make things funny. So, but this is I have now a 10-yard commute across the garden.
Beautiful. This is, and it's really just so that people can sort of visualise this. I have to say, on my way over, when you said, you know, text me when you arrive, I'll be in the shed.
Yeah.
I did envisage something about a quarter of the size of this,
made
of wood with a little sloping roof. This is very, I mean, this is what Londoners would call an office.
Yes.
It's effectively a porter cabin, only way nicer.
Yes, it's a porter cabin that you can't port, I guess.
A cabin.
A cabin. There we are. We've finally found the right word. So I believe it's 3 by 4.5 meters, if I can remember from when we had it.
That sounds like you've been pacing around it, Mike, making chalk blocks.
We ordered it, and then they made it and then brought it in and put it up. It took about 3 days.
And do you like being in here? Does it keep you feeling silly?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it's better than being in the house and being reminded of all the things you're supposed to be doing in the house.
So you're able to sort of close the door and go, there are, you know, bills to pay and washing to be done, but I'm at work.
And, children to attend to, whatever.
Yes.
You know, just lock them inside, be done with it.
So what does your... I don't know, I'm going to flounder a little bit here because I feel like I've seen loads of your Edinburgh shows. I have seen loads of your Edinburgh shows, and I have listened to almost every single episode of The Bugle since it started as well.
Wow.
Like, since back in the day. I'm not one of these insane people that goes, I've just caned 5 years' worth in, you know, 3 months or however long that talks. And we've gigged together once or twice as well.
Yeah.
I was trying to remember, I think the last time we gigged together was with Otis Cannelloni in Pete Jonas's gig, The Comedy Carnival. So that's going back some years now.
Yes.
Yeah. So I feel like there's so much that we can talk about you and what you do and all the rest of it, and people will be thrilled because obviously I would say something like 100% of my listenership probably also listens to The Bugle.
Oh, okay.
And they will be thrilled to see that you are literally live streaming cricket in the background.
I write about cricket as well, so I'm technically at the coalface as we speak with New Zealand v West Indies on.
I suppose we should start by, for people that don't know you, for the very few people that don't know you, can you just describe the various things that you do now? Because when I first met you, you were predominantly a stand-up comedian and a comedy writer. You wrote topical sketches and things like that. What are the main things that occupy your work at the minute?
Well, The Bugle is the main thing. That's my sort of weekly podcast with John Oliver. That's topical, satirical, mixture of news and bullshit, as you have exposed yourself to a frankly unhealthy degree by the sounds of it. That's the main thing. That's the sort of focus of my week. So we record that now. We always recorded it on Friday. We just moved to Thursday since John started doing his new HBO show in the States. So that's the highlight of my week, I guess. You know, having that complete blank canvas to do whatever we want, which even in the days when we were hosted by the Times and paid by Times Online, they never interfered. So we've always had that kind of freedom. So it fairly rapidly after we started almost 7 years ago became the main focal point of my creative week, I guess. Apart from that, I write about cricket for Crick Info and do videos for them. So that's, I guess, quite a major part of the week as well. Then gigs and bits of radio that come and go. So I have quite a broad range of different things to do. So there's every day I usually have something I either have to get finished or ought to get finished.
Okay.
And the things that I do get finished are the things that I have to get finished, not the ones that I ought to get finished. They then become the things I have to get finished, usually piling up and being finished at 5 a.m. here in this shed as the sun is coming up outside. Me thinking, I have to take my children to school in 3 hours. This is not a healthy way to live and work.
And is it an enjoyable way to work? Do you enjoy that sort of pressure? Because I speak as someone who just this morning has been having a near anxiety attack or the stress of getting one or two things done that were slightly over. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like for me, the podcast, which I now release weekly and have help with producing it and editing it and so forth, that stresses me out constantly. And I often find that because I'm writing, I'm always writing towards the next Edinburgh show. I'm doing a lot of stand-up at the moment, so there's a lot of what I do. But I find that the stress of having jokes to write is, you know, an enjoyable stress in some ways, but it really, I feel like I'm terrible at multitasking.
Yes.
From what you've described, you've got a huge amount of things going on.
Yes.
It fun to wrangle with them all, or does it freak you out?
Generally it's fun. Sometimes it does pile up and it feels like you're meeting deadlines rather than creating what you want to create, which I think is when the best comedy comes, is probably a mixture of both, where there's the compulsion of having to get something done, but also you're essentially choosing to do it. So sometimes, inevitably every comedian takes on too much when it's there, so sometimes it does pile up. It's not really multitasking, I guess it's sequential unitasking. Is that a term? That must be a term in business, I'm sure.
Definitely.
I'm a bit out of the loop with business terminology. So, but generally, I always find that I'm inherently lazy, therefore, without an actual deadline that I'm going to be told off if I miss, or embarrassed if I miss, then I don't get much done. So, it helps having lots of those deadlines in a lot of ways.
And you say the Bugle quickly became kind of more important to you than stand-up, or occupying more of your time than stand-up?
Yes. So we started doing that in late 2007. John went to the States in mid-2006. My career was frankly going nowhere at the time.
Well, this is we get onto the Bugle stuff, let's talk about this, because it is something, it's a running joke of the Bugle and I believe your life from having seen you on stage and known you personally a small amount. But one of the jokes is that you are, one of the features is that things were terrible for you as a stand-up.
Right.
Like, you know, you and John are, you're constantly sort of saying, oh, you know, back when we had five people in a, you know, an art centre in Kendall and stuff like that.
Yes.
And that's something that I think really resonates a lot, because not only does it set you as an underdog, but also to myself as a comic who listens to it, I go, oh, I've been to that gig, I've been to that art centre, you know.
And also as a comic, you're probably thinking, yes, I had six at that.
Yeah. If I was lucky enough to have had six, I would be thinking that. But so let's start off with you as a stand-up. Was stand-up the first thing you did in comedy?
Yes. It was, I guess. It was the first thing I did in what proper comedy. I guess the first things I did in terms of making things to try and make people laugh was when I used to write sports pages on a student newspaper and just fill them with absolute bullshit. I used to make up events if I had to actually report an event that a few people cared about. It's a student sport, fundamentally. No one apart from the people in it cared about it. So you could be a bit more creative. But, I'd sort of make up little narratives to go along to be a reporter for a hockey match and claim that Marlon Brando was having a fight with a combine harvester in the background or something. Which was great fun to do. And,
Did you sort of get away with that? Did people like that?
Yeah, people did seem to like it. Not necessarily the people who were in the sports teams. But, people seem to like it. And make up events like the sort of inter-universities doubt harbouring competition or whatever. So that was, where I started trying to write funny things. The problem with that was that when I then left university to try and get a job in journalism, I had a portfolio of absolutely unusable bilge. And spent 6 months on the dole looking for a job.
If you were writing that stuff when you were a student,
yeah,
and you were thinking, I want to get a job in journalism, was any part of you thinking that some of it might, or that those skills might one day be useful? Or were you sort of thinking, well, I'm going to have to do the proper stuff for my job?
I've never had much of a long-term plan.
It's a man sitting in his shed.
Yeah. And the long-term plan has brought me here at the age of 39.
Incredible.
Sitting in the in my shed with New Zealand v West Indies streaming on the internet.
You've nailed it.
That's where do I go from here, Stuart? I don't think I really knew what I wanted. I had this vague idea that I wanted to be a sports journalist just because I loved sport and was pretty sceptical about reality. I did a little bit of stand-up at university, and I didn't really think of it as a possible career. And,
so were you doing sensible sports journalism at uni as well as the silly stuff?
No. Maybe I should have been, and then I might not have had quite such trouble then getting a job afterwards. I did a little bit of stand-up, then gave that up after a harrowing open mic night in Edinburgh at the festival in 1997 that went so badly that I thought, I'm now retiring after one proper gig, basically, and then didn't do stand-up again for about 18 months. So, stand-up was my main focus for a couple of years, and then I guess I started trying to think of things beyond that, radio stuff.
So with the stand-up stuff that you did, were you kind of... I mean, I'm trying to envisage what that stuff was. Was it you doing sport plus bullshit type stuff, or was it political at that
it was,
point?
No, it was neither of those things. I always wanted to do political comedy. I'd studied ancient Greek comedy at university, and that's really strongly political. And I guess I liked, the more political stuff on television. So, but I didn't have the balls to do it for a couple of years, really, until I did my first solo Edinburgh show. What I did initially was, I guess, a mixture of... I can't really remember. I've got some recordings of it. It was some quite surreal stuff. I remember doing a routine about being given a Scotsman for Christmas. In fact, in that gig that made me give up in Edinburgh, that's where I opened with this routine about being given a Scotsman for Christmas and an audience full of drunken Scots. That proved to be a strategic misstep. I can't remember what else I had. What other routines I had. So it was sort of surreal nonsense, and then the harsh expediencies of the circuit made it, I guess, more middle of the road for a bit, and I then did the Comedy Zone in Edinburgh in 2000 with a set that was frankly shit.
Who else was on your...
Danny Boy, Karen Taylor and Spencer Brown.
Okay.
And I think I'd sort of, as a lot of comedians do, you do what you can to get a laugh, and then I realised at the end of that I wasn't very good at it, and B, that it wasn't really what I wanted to do long term. So I started then trying to do more political stuff and more inventive stuff. So I guess all comedians go through various phases early on as kind of working out how not to get booed off stage.
Is that, was that something, I mean, and again, going back to what you and John often talk about on the Bugle, about some sort of disastrous, catastrophic kind of gigs, is that you talking up for fun kind of your feelings of uncertainty, or were you getting horrible reactions from people?
Well, no, I mean, no, it was, I wouldn't say I was getting horrible reactions, that makes it sound like that's what happened all the time, but I did get some horrible reactions, but I think, you know, if I'd just had awful reactions, I'd have given up. But if there's enough good ones, then you balance it out. But at the same time, there were some gigs where I had... I split the room into the room and me. So, and, you know, that's part of the joy of stand-up, is the, you know, the success and the failure. Particularly if you're, you know, if you're a sport, obsessed with sport as I am, that's as close as you come to playing kind of professional sport, is having those wins and losses building up
okay.
the gig column. So, but yeah, we had both individually and as a double act had some pretty harsh gigs. Took some heavy casualties.
And did you? I'm sort of trying to imagine what it would be like to see you go out to battle. You know, go into bat if you like.
Yeah.
You know, or out to battle. I'm not a sports fan at all.
Yeah.
And. I'm trying to imagine you kind of try. What was your, like, did you ever do the commercial clubs? Did you ever do Jonglers?
I used to do the occasional paid 10-minute slot in Camden and Battersea clubs, but never regularly. Did a few spots at the Glee Club, occasional spots at the Comedy Store, but I was never in massive demand on the club circuit.
Sure, sure.
And... yeah, wasn't very good at it and didn't much enjoy it. So I guess me and the club circuit reached a mutual decision to let each other go our separate ways.
And, I mean, you still do solo stand-up now. You've been doing Edinburgh shows.
Yeah, yeah.
Loads. So, I mean, there is... You're still attracted to the idea of stand-up.
Yes.
But it's a case of not... Because I'm sort of fascinated with this idea of people who are brave enough to keep doing their own thing.
Yeah.
And if they find that their own thing isn't working, rather than dilute it and make it work, people who are brave enough to stop or wait until they have their own audience or something.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing a lot of comics feel. I've got all of these ideals of what I want to be.
Yeah.
Oh, shit, no one's going for it.
Yes. Yes, I guess there's an element of that. There's an element of just basic practicality about it as well. If you're not very good at something, there's no point carrying on doing it. But if, you know... So I guess I found that certainly when I did my first Edinburgh show and went quite well, albeit not in a commercial or audience numbers way, that I guess that gave me the confidence to...
Was that the nominated show,
so
The Dog of Doom?
Which was great fun to do, and I think that's when I sort of worked out what I wanted to do vaguely and with stand-up and developed, a style that was... more distinctively my own, and yeah, I guess I just looked for outlets where that would work, whether it was doing Edinburgh or radio, I guess, where you can be a bit more creative with what you're doing rather than, you know, the club circuit at, you know, doing gigs at weekends. It can be quite restrictive in terms of what you can try to do, so yeah, it's a mixture of... I'm not sure there's a great deal of idealism about it, but it was really... I just finding the niches where I could do what I wanted to do and the things that I was better at.
One of the probably the funniest I've ever seen you be would be at the Honourable Men of Art during Ask Andy.
Oh, right,
when
yeah.
Kitson would field... He'd kind of... There was often the end of that show.
Yeah, yeah.
That Daniel Kitson would field questions, put them to you, and you would improvise so brilliantly.
Right.
I mean, that was explosive. Yeah. You must have happy memories of doing that.
It was great fun. It was, some of the most enjoyable gigs I've had. And as you would have... If you'd seen my stand-up in the early days, as you probably did, I was always quite stuck with material. I didn't divert much from it, and doing that show sort of forced me into areas that I hadn't really ever been as a comedian or was ever likely to go had I been left on my own.
Sure.
But
was that Daniel's idea to sort of let's do this now?
I can't really remember. There wasn't a lot of planning in that show. It just things sort of happened or evolved. I can't really remember how it came about, but it was great fun doing it. And yeah, I mean, it wasn't. I think you might have seen it on a good night.
I saw it several times.
I remember being sometimes good and sometimes less good. So
every time I saw it, you were right on the money, and I'm really fascinated with that dynamic between you as. You're a writer. You spend a lot of time writing. You're known predominantly for not necessarily your writing, but the performance of your stuff, which is very densely written.
Yeah.
You know, the first name that comes to my mind is the congressman's penis. Whatever. But you know, some of the stuff that makes you most distinctive from other comics is very, very densely written.
Yes.
And I was really interested with how, when you were kind of released from that by Daniel throwing a question from an audience member at you, that you just knocked it out of the park over and over again. And I just wonder if it's maybe something to do with the idea of a double act or a partnership that lifts you out of your temptation to write.
There's a lot in that. Also, you know, I'd done the double act with John for sort of 2 years live before we went to the States, and we'd done radio stuff for a few years as well, and done little bits in each other's shows. So we'd had a bit of a live dynamic. That was the first thing I'd done on stage with Kitson and Alan, and David O'Doherty did it as well. So, having things to feed off, you have to rely more on your instincts. I guess also I'd been in stand-up for about 7 years probably when we did the first Honourable Men of Art season. Basically treat it like Mad Men, but nattier costumes. I guess the process of writing creates certain mental processes where you make these links or disassociations that a lot of comedy comes from. And if you... I'm having sort of written things like that for a long time, I guess there's an element of your brain that then learns to do it very quickly and instinctively. And that's also happened during the years we've done The Bugle, which started sort of after that first run of Men of Art. I can't remember if we did Ask Andy both years, anyway. We tend to write with not a great deal of time to the recording deadline. So I certainly write in, I think, quite an improvisational way, where I have an idea, write it out. It's basically often a first draft that we record. So it's not sort of Ross Noble type improvisation, but you're sort of accelerating the mental processes that go into creating comedy. So I guess doing that on stage is another step in that.
Yeah,
there's process.
Certainly some of the funniest moments of The Bugle are when you guys make each other laugh when you join in. And case in point, I was listening to the most recent episode with that little throwback to the 12 fucks and a cunt joke.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Which I almost feel terrible saying, because I'm used to hearing your voice bleeped out when you swear.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you know, again, a perfect example of you just, you know, the ball coming over to you and smashing it back. I mean, that's a wonderful joke.
Yeah, that...
We don't need to explain the contents of the joke, because I'm keen to direct people to the latest episode of The Bugle. Yeah, right, if they haven't heard already.
Yeah, but it was... I mean, that was one of the very rare occasions where I just riffed the joke on the spot, and it sort of came out almost perfectly. So it just happened maybe 3 times in my career. But that one line, that was for those who've not seen it or can't be asked to look it up. We bleep out our swears on The Bugle because basically I think find it funnier.
It's funnier, yeah, definitely, yeah.
And so I asked Chris, our producer, because we'd had quite a sweary start, how many swears we'd had, and he said, "In quite a sweary start, you've had 12 fucks and one cunt." And I said, "Well, that's basically a Jewish summary of the New Testament," and it just came out. But I think that was an example of what I was saying, that there's, you know, I have a lot of jokes that sort of touch on my Judaism or
the
lack of the quality of my Judaism, being a very bad Jew, and religion stuff vaguely. So it was just, I guess, making that link between two, you know, the numbers 12 and 1, and Jesus and the Disciples. And I guess over the years, I suppose I've trained my mind.
Yes.
Not deliberately, it just sort of happened to make those associations quickly, I suppose.
And those are, I think that's a really good example. I think what we're talking about here is the fact that when you're, certainly I feel when I'm writing, if I've had a period of 3 weeks, say, I've been away or I've not been working, whatever, suddenly you're grinding to try and come up with stuff. When you're match fit, when you're writing all the time, that engine is very finely tuned, and as a result, you can be naturally funny more easily.
Yeah, and it's almost, I mean, to go back to sport, you'd hear sportsmen talking about being in the zone or whatever, in a state where they're not consciously thinking about what they're doing, but things are just have a rhythm to them and they're reacting on their trained instincts. And I think there can be an element of that in both performing and writing comedy, where it's often at its best, where it's not necessarily a non-conscious process, but almost sort of semi-conscious, where you're just relying on the processes that you've developed in your creative side over several years.
So this is Andy. I got exactly what I wanted out of this interview. I'm sorry if it's a little bit long. On the other hand, some of you will be thinking, hooray, it's a little bit long. Andy's such a nice guy, and he gave some really thoughtful answers. I'm particularly fascinated with this, with the dichotomy between the written stuff and his improvisation, and which of them provides the best results, and how we as comics try to stimulate one from the other. Later on, we're going to be talking about the way the Bugle is made, and Andy's also very candid about what it feels like to be half a double act when your former partner is becoming insanely successful. Do join the Facebook group, or you can follow at ComComPod on Twitter to get the most immediate updates and teasers on who's coming next. I do wonder if I'm getting a little bit over-familiar with the current ComCom music. If anyone would like to do a cover version for me in a different instrument, maybe you play the clarinet. Maybe I don't even know what a clarinet sounds like. Email me info@comedianscomedian.com if you'd like to contribute some music or some stings. I might try starting to mix that up a bit. And on the subject of the music, do look on the Facebook group. The brilliant Dan Melrose, who recorded the original Twiddles for me, has released an album, and it's fantastic. So please have a look. That's on Bandcamp. His name's Dan Melrose, or you can find a link on the Facebook page. Thank you, finally, for all of your donations. Do keep them coming in if you'd like. Remember, if you don't want to donate, please feel free to share the podcast with all and sundry. That's just as helpful to me. And if you would like to donate, then you can, of course, just click on the PayPal button at comedianscomedian.com. I would really appreciate your support. Any amount you choose, £5, £10, £20, or do I hear £1 a show? That would be very kind of you. I've just recorded Nick Doody. We've got Armour Rahman coming out next week, and the following week is going to be Nick Doody, and that's an absolute blinder. It's up there, I think, with the Gary Delaney episode in terms of there being a single moment where someone says, oh, what, jokes? Yeah, they work like this. And then giving a really, really interesting and unique take on how to write a really good joke. And some of you will know Nick Doody from Radio 4. Some of you will know him from the circuit. He's one of those guys that's I don't think has anything like the profile that he deserves, but watching his live stand-up is just joyous. I think I said in the interview to him, he's like one of those John Gordillo, Simon Evans types where you kind of just go, this is blissful, tag, 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 tag. So look forward to that. Armour Rahman next week. Now, let's get back to the brilliant Andy Zaltzman. Are you happiest writing in your shed on your own, or playing with other people?
Well, I do most of my stuff solo, and I'm not sure that's entirely psychologically healthy. I'd love to work in a team. I loved working with John when he was here, because we had, I think, quite similar approaches to comedy, and we worked really well as a writing team. But that was just two of us, really. And when we worked as part of a bigger team, it generally didn't work very well. But I think because we had, our style was too distinctive, and we probably weren't very adaptable. I don't know. I'm not sure there's a happiest or. I sort of enjoy both, really, but I'd certainly like to do some more collaborative stuff than I currently do, which is mostly sitting in this shed for too many hours a day, being intermittently
overproductive to a deadline and unproductive without one. So,
and what do you do when you're unproductive? Do you? But I can imagine you bouncing a squash ball off the wall.
Not on the wall of my beautiful shed. Damage it like that. I don't know. I will often end up just, you know, reading newspaper articles on the internet or looking up sporting stats for out of just interest or for my next cricket piece or whatever. So, or I will just end up writing something and deleting it, writing it again and deleting it again. So, yeah, I've never fully found a super efficient way of getting things written.
Do you have any kind of principles that you work to of when you are staring down the barrel of a deadline, you go, right, I've got to do this. Do you have... And it's interesting, actually, because your style is so distinctive, I almost wonder what... I mean, what would you... If you were to describe the kind of the key patterns that you work to, or tropes that you use, say, what would those be? I mean, I sort of feel like I know some of them, but I'd like to hear what you your take on it.
I haven't thought about it very much, really. I don't know. I guess a lot of it, particularly in stand-up, is creating analogies. So if you're looking at a political issue, try and find a way of expressing the comedic or satirical point you want to make without really talking directly about that issue. So it's sort of, I think in doing it that way, you can avoid feeling like you're hectoring an audience. There's quite a lot of analogy. I'm not really sure apart from that. I mean, quite often it's just trying to find a, particularly on the Bugle, doing a lot of quite heavy news stories, just trying to find an angle that deals with something that is inherently massively tragic or depressing or worrying in a light way that nevertheless makes some kind of satirical point, whether directly or obliquely. But I don't know, what would you say?
Well, I just want to sort of put a pin in dealing with tragic subjects. I want to come back to that in a minute, because I think that's something you guys do phenomenally well, and I'm always really impressed by when those subjects come up on the Bugle and you're like, oh God, we've got to talk about people being gassed or whatever it is, something awful, something sort of globally tragic. But we'll come back to that in a moment. I think, yeah, certainly analogies. I think you have an incredible facility for taking a silly idea like Michelangelo painting the Sistine Chapel or the Queen Victoria walks into a bar joke.
Oh, right, yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And just put you are very fond, I think, of setting up almost like as a piece, not exactly as a sketch, but it's almost like it has the trappings of a sketch, like a person does a thing.
Yeah.
We can imagine that person doing this and then pursuing it for a very long time, like squeezing everything out of it and then coming up with other sort of things along the way. Obviously, there's a lot of stuff about what a terrible Jew you are.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, religion is a sort of fixation as well, generally speaking. I mean, this is another question. Again, I know what you mean by and a load of bullshit.
Yeah.
What is bullshit to you? What? Because it's something that this is, it's a frequent...
We're getting very philosophical now. Yeah, what is bullshit? When Aristotle addressed this many years ago, his treatise, What is Bullshit? A bullshit, I guess, is essentially sort of the type of bullshit that I do on the Bugle is, I suppose, absurdity that sounds like it has some link with reality, presented in a sort of parodic style, as if it's real. So I do a lot of things on the Bugle, kind of spoof restaurants, taking the piss out of modern kind of Blumenthal style cuisine with a celebrity chef called Scluton Malvane, and just stupid dishes that, and if you present it in quite a serious way, as if it's true, I think that generally makes it work better as comedy. So I guess it's a lie coated in a casing of false truth.
That's interesting. Okay. And are there, because like how much when you're writing something like the congressman's penis, so yeah. sit brackets CW, I'm not going to explain. Yeah. Do you edit that stuff? Is it a stream of consciousness?
That particular thing was largely a stream of consciousness from the initial premise of a kind of PI discovering the severed penis of a congressman. Then
I mean, this is already stretching the word premise to its absolute limits.
Yeah, that rock solid premise clearly deserved to be written. That was quite instinct, quite stream of consciousness. Like I say, a lot of the Bugle is written in a very sort of rapid and instinctive way, I think. So it was taking the idea and seeing what comes out in a first draft, or then go over it probably once with that kind of thing and try and tighten it up. But I think I slightly ran out of steam after episode 2 and it fizzled out a bit. But
to cheers of relief, yeah. from the listenership.
But the first one I thought was really funny.
Yeah.
And then after that, I couldn't quite work out how to.
I wish you'd kept going with the audio cryptic crossword.
Well, we finished the crossword. So that was the when we started the Bugle, the idea was to do it in the format of a newspaper. Yes. So we still call it an audio newspaper, although it sort of became less that. We sort of didn't drop the format, but it just evolved beyond that fairly rapidly. But the idea of having an audio crossword with a single clue every week. So I really enjoyed doing, and I quite like doing
it. I've got some of them.
So, I mean, crossword clues are essentially quite like puns. Essentially, mm-hmm. It's a lot of double meanings of words. So, what are we doing? How do we get on to that?
With in terms of the bullshit, the editing process of the bullshit. Because I suppose what I'm getting at is there a way for you, like, do you look at some bullshit that you've written and go, this can be better bullshit?
Yes.
And if you do, what do you do to it to make it better?
Well, I think part of the way that it's worked on the Bugle is because we have quite a devoted listenership. It's not really an in joke, but it's something that sort of works within the context of the Bugle. That type of bullshit in stand-up might not necessarily work in quite the same format, but there's often in a piece of bullshit.
I don't know what the word is for a unit of bullshit. Yes,
a clod of bullshit. There's an idea that can be transferred to something else, whether a more serious bit of radio or stand-up. If there's a bit that I think, that's funny, a way of developing it is to just rewrite it, whether that's rewriting, going over the text you've written and editing it as you go along and trying to think of new twists in it, or rewriting it from scratch using the same idea and seeing what comes out second time, or just doing it at a gig and talking it out and seeing how people react to it and where there might, you often only by sort of doing it from in front of different audiences you find different angles within a routine and just different wordings to find out where the best laughter points are. So, generally, I think most routines can be improved by sort of going over them again. With all things, you can always find a new angle. But at the same time, I think often that sort of instinctive core of the idea is often strongest when it's just sort of flown out of nothing, and if you then go over it in too sort of conscious a way, it can become forced. So I don't know, I'm not sure there's any. It works very differently for each clod.
What it puts me in mind of is something I saw, and I don't remember who was presenting at the time, but on an episode of Nevermind the Buzzcocks, call it Simon Amstel, I don't think it was Amstel, Noel Fielding was on it, and obviously he deals in surreal rather than absurd, and I've never really made a distinction between those two things before this conversation, going, it isn't surreal what you do, is it? It's absurd, and that's different slightly.
Yes, I guess, yes.
Yes, yeah. And just the example was, he sort of, the presenter said, oh, it's easy what you do, I could do it now, oh, I can ride around on my own pillow or something. And then Noel Fielding obviously said something like, yes, but I can ride around on my own tears. Yeah. Or, do you know what I mean? And it was, yeah, yeah. And it got such a bigger laugh, and you go, oh, you really are. Do you know what I mean? There is some qualitative difference,
yes,
in that surrealism. I wondered if that's the same in the absurdism that you do, that you kind of go, there are ideas which are absurd and zany and silly, but sort of too close to normal life to get a laugh? Or are there other... What's your...
Yeah,
say something about that mess of a question, Andy.
I don't know. I don't know, really. I mean, a lot of it is... it's just sort of feeling what you think is funniest, and that, I guess, is part of the craft of being a comedian, and sometimes that feeling is right and sometimes it's wrong, and often you don't know until you say it and record it or perform it in front of an audience. When you do get, obviously, a reaction, there might be something that you think, my instinct is right on this, and the audience disagrees with that in the strongest available terms. So,
And is there, because presumably when you're recording the bugle, you don't have time to go and try those those clods out in front of a live audience.
Yes.
So you're just kind of taking it on.
Yeah, just trusting the. Trusting the instincts that created it, I guess, and and hoping that you've got enough of an audience that likes those instincts, I suppose.
Going back to the idea of. And we'll come back in a minute to this sort of dealing with tragedy. I just want to talk a little bit about political comedy and what you see how political you see your comedy is. Because obviously you're dealing with topical subjects. You're obviously very well read. You know what's going on in the world. And do you feel that you're using your material or your act or your comedy in whatever shape it is to try and effect political change?
No. I think to do that you need, I guess, an audience of sufficient heft. So that's not really the purpose.
Do you mean in terms of the size of them? Like if you had the ear of 10 million people, you could make a difference?
Yeah, so I think, so The Daily Show in the States, I think, does have some effect, not necessarily on the politics, but on the discourse and the way that people think about... think about politics, but just doing political comedy without that audience, you're unlikely to change things, and it's not really the purpose, certainly, of what I do. And there might be at times when a routine I do about a certain subject might slightly make people think of something in a different way, but that's not the purpose of the political comedy that I do. That said, if you do then get into a position where you do have that audience, then clearly it can have that effect. So I think one of the reasons John's been so successful in the States was because he worked very hard on his political comedy here. So when he got to The Daily Show, he was he had the experience of doing that to go into that team and make a strong and distinctive impact. So, without an audience, I really do it because that's what I love doing and what I think I'm best at, I guess. But in terms of it having a campaigning purpose...
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
It doesn't really have that. I think it can have that, and clearly you have people like Mark Thomas and Robert Newman who have a more sort of campaigning and journalistic element to their comedy. But Mark Thomas's campaigns clearly they have some some effects, but it's I guess the effect that it can have, political comedies, in terms of, you know, contributing to an overall overall campaign rather than necessarily being the focus in itself. And also with YouTube and the internet now, with things going viral, then it's possible to use comedy as a vehicle for alerting people to important issues or shedding a new light on them. I know some guys in India who did a video about sort of misogyny in Indian culture, and it got millions of hits very, very quickly. And therefore, I think it was using comedy to address a very difficult issue in a funny way, which is quite a powerful tool, I suppose. But it's in terms of having an impact, it all depends on the size and nature of the audience, I think.
Something that always troubles me when I realise how unpolitical my comedy is.
Yeah.
I worry that I'm not engaging with a political process. I'm not taking part. I used to absolutely idolise Mark Thomas. I used to love his stuff on Channel 4, you know, all the Mark Thomas comedy products and stuff. It was so exciting to me as a kind of early, you know, teenager, was in my early 20s. It used to seem so radical and just common sense and come on, guys, you know what I mean? It was like, I've made it sound awful, but you know what I mean? It used to really inspire me. And I've always felt a bit guilty that I don't do anything like that in my own comedy. But I suppose what I'm asking is, from what you're saying, it's almost like if you don't have the audience, if not you, or if a comedian doesn't have the audience to effect some change, then might his comedy as well be about pigeons as it is about politics?
Yes, it might as well be. I think the best comedy is comedy that has a degree of honesty about it. And if what your sort of comedic soul wants to do is comedy about pigeons, then do that. I don't think there's any intrinsic superiority in doing political or non-political comedy. People criticise McIntyre for doing comedy about nothing much in particular, but I think, well, I don't really like it, but there's an authenticity to it. It seems that that's what he is as a comedian. It seems pointless to gripe about it. It's what he wants to do and what people clearly like hearing. So, I don't think there's... I mean, I don't think you should feel you have to do something as a comedian because you think that is the right thing to do. I mean, it might be worth having a go and seeing how you get on with it. But, like I say, I mean, I always wanted to do political comedy because I'd studied it a bit and enjoyed watching it. But I've never thought there's a superiority in doing it. It's just what I wanted to do. And so like I said, I think the best comedy is what comes naturally from within the comedian, whatever that happens to be.
I read a quote or something you said, something attributed to you in an interview, which is that I find the more I know about an issue, the less I know what to think about it.
Yes, yeah.
I can totally see that. I mean, that's something I find myself, and I'm sure a lot of other comics, find really blocking, because actually, how can you take a comic line on something without necessarily ignoring some of the counter-arguments or making some of the counter-arguments seem stupid or writing them off?
Yes.
Because comedy isn't the same as discourse.
That can be difficult, and clearly life and politics have a lot of nuance in them, and it is a bit easier to do things if they're simple and black and white. So I guess that's one of the challenges is to make of doing political comedy, is to, you know, not necessarily express a standpoint, but address an issue in a way that has sort of authenticity from having sufficient knowledge about it, but without necessarily, as you say, the more you read about the economy or whatever, it's clear there are no right and wrong answers. It's guesswork up to the very top level. So as a comedian, what can, I mean, how do you process that and turn it into something that's a 30-second joke? I don't know. I don't know if that's possible. But
I mean, I suppose then, the way most comedians would approach that, and I count myself guilty amongst this as well, is asking someone what they do for a living. They say banker, everyone goes, ooh.
Yes.
And you kind of go, ha-ha, see?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You kind of like... Yeah.
But then there's also comedy to be had from the confusion, from not understanding things, and the fact that not only do just ordinary people not understand it, but top-level economic journalists don't seem to understand it or be able to express it, and top-level politicians and economists are often getting things wrong and sticking the tail on the wrong donkey. So, I mean, it can be, but I think there's a lot of very different ways of doing political comedy that don't involve an absolute confidence in your standpoint. At the same time, there's often smaller issues within an issue in which there is a clear, you know, right and wrong, or at least a clear positions to be taken.
I think I know what you mean. Can you think of an example of a sort of sub issue like
that? Off the top of my head.
And we can cut out any time in between to make you look cleverer.
Making sure there wasn't a 2-hour gap. Yeah. I don't know. I guess, there's some stuff that I did about fair trade years ago that I still occasionally do, which is, I guess, highlighting the idea that the commercial exploitation of the developing world is wrong or naughty. But at the same time, there's, you know, within our economy, there's an economic practicality to it that, I mean, are we prepared to not do that and everything to be more expensive or whatever? There's so many different ways of looking at the overall global picture. But within that, the idea that you ruthlessly exploit workers with no rights in poor countries, there shouldn't be that much argument about it. So I guess, you know, you can pick on a sub-subject within a broader issue.
Does something like the example you just mentioned, does that make you angry? Does the idea of people with no rights being exploited, does that, you know, as a... I'm writing... And I will try and make myself sound less hesitant and all over the place as well, but... because I'm not dealing with that stuff in my material, I'm dealing about my own anxieties and fears and, you know, all those, you know, and, you know, nice things as well. Yeah. Please come and see me 7 o'clock at the Pleasance. But I'm dealing with the kind of the events I'm experiencing. So I don't need to worry about an emotional connection to those sorts of topics. If you are in your own comedy or on the Bugle dealing with those things, does your anger come into it? Do you ever feel like, I don't want to write about this, this is horrible?
It can do. There are not many issues where it makes me feel that I don't want to necessarily write about it. But obviously, it's a question of taking an angle that has taste and dignity in it, and addresses the, you know, whatever the heart of the satirical issue is. So rather than focusing on a particularly tragic element of it, you're looking at a broader political picture. But, I mean, anger's clearly can be very effective in comedy, whether it's anger about the injustices of the world or anger about how difficult it is to buy the right pair of trousers or whatever. You know, it works on all ends of the comedic spectrum.
I mean, well, let's talk then about the process for the Bugle. Something I wonder listening to it, you and John write your own stuff and then perform your own stuff to each other and try and make each other laugh?
Yes, that's exactly...
That's how it feels like.
That's exactly what happens, which, again, from when we started, was largely a logistical thing that John was busy with The Daily Show. So I think we initially thought we might be a bit more collaborative about, you know, working on things together and exchange things to and fro, but it was just easier to do it, to write separately, and I think it worked more effectively. So we just agree on the stories, then write and come together for recording and not know what each other are going to say, and I think that's where the
that brings the element of spontaneity to it. So it's a mixture of written and spontaneous, which
yes,
I think is
because
quite,
then you can effective. Top each other's jokes.
Yeah.
And occasionally I notice kind of moments where you'll take a similar angle or something, but then one of you will be keen to go, well, it is like just what yes. you said, because also here's my two yeah. toppers that you haven't covered.
Yes, that does happen quite a lot, and often there'll be bits that, you know, John will do a big spiel at the start and I'll think, right, that's 500 words, that's not worth me doing because I've basically written the same joke.
Right, okay.
So
how much do you prepare before you go into the studio to record an episode of it?
Well, it's I don't know, I guess a whole day's writing. I usually end up with a document of sort of 2,500 to 4,000 words, depending on.
Okay.
Not all of that gets used.
I was going to say, do you record, like, presumably some of it you record and some of it you don't even say, and then yeah. of the recording some of it gets cut or saved for some cockamamie best of episode.
Well, we now tend to when we were at the Times, we had a bit of a longer time in the studio, so we tended to record a bit too much and cut some bits out, whereas now pretty much everything we record goes into the show because we have a 1 hour slot in the recording studio. So it changed a bit, but we basically use almost everything that we write, so there's an incentive to try and make it good rather than just write lots of things and see what works. You have to sort of try and get it right the first time.
And when you're dealing with, just to briefly come back to this, dealing with difficult subjects, do you have any kind of rules? Do you personally, or between you as a double act, do you have any sort of sense of, like, we wouldn't really touch XYZ, you know, or if we did talk about this topic, then we'd need to pull back from certain angles of it?
Not really. I think that's just a question of basic judgment of taste and... you know, we don't really set out to offend, and I don't, you know, our comedy
unless it's Rupert Murdoch.
I don't think he noticed. If you're offended by something, you're going to notice it. But there might be stuff that's provocative, but I hope it's not intentionally offensive. So it's really just making a judgment on what is and isn't in bad taste, which is usually quite an easy judgment to make, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Even on, you know, a really difficult issue like a war or
I mean, particularly if you're dealing with war and disaster in an immediate way. I don't listen to a huge amount of political or topical comedy,
yeah.
and often, as you'll know, what happens to filter down in the clubs is 2 years old anyway. By the time,
yeah.
hey, remember that? You know, remember that thing from a couple of years ago? Yeah. But you do respond. Obviously, the nature of the podcast is such that you respond almost immediately to a lot of things. And I find myself listening, kind of going, oh my God, what are they going to do with this?
Right.
And you always pull it out of the bag.
Oh, that's good.
And try and find some, you know, some sort of angle on it. I don't know, this isn't a question. I've fallen apart. But this is, do you know what I mean? I think...
Well, I guess that is our job, I suppose.
Yeah.
If you can call it a job. bullshitting for a living. But, you know, that's what we've been doing for... over a decade. John's been doing in the States for 8 years now, and we've been doing on the Bugle for sort of 7 years, so that's, yeah, I would hope we could mostly get it right on those things, otherwise we'd have wasted a lot of time, so.
How would you characterise the dynamic between you and John? What are your different roles within it?
I don't know, I guess I do more of the subsidiary bullshit. His stuff tends to be more focused on the big news stories, which I also do, but I would do the more kind of parodic elements of, you know, the using the format of it being an audio newspaper and the things like the standalone pieces like the congressman's penis or the restaurant things I was talking about earlier on. Other than that, there's too much difference in our functions within the show, really. But
given John's incredible acceleration into huge, you know, fame in America and all the rest of it, If you didn't have a family over here, would you have tried to, would you have been, you know, tried to kind of engage with that more? Would you have moved to America with him and tried to blag yourself a job on The Daily Show or on a writer's staff or the rest of it?
I don't know, really. I mean, I'd love to work with him again on stuff, whether it's on his current HBO show or other things. I hope we'd get to do something together again. But, yeah, there were clearly logistical difficulties with that. Also, you know, that's sort of his... I guess, if I were to go there, I would necessarily be sort of tagging along a bit, whereas, you know, I guess I'd hopefully try and carve my own niches back here and with my cricket stuff and whatever. But, yeah, it's... there's been times when it's been quite difficult, that the openings for political comedy in Britain are almost nil, really. There's very light topical game shows and a very established kind of closed shop on Radio 4 for topical comedy. So it's it can get a bit frustrating that there doesn't seem to be the desire to aim as high with political comedy as there is in the States. So but I don't know what would have happened had I been single and without familial responsibilities. It was quite an extraordinary month when it was in mid-2006, John got offered the Daily Show job. In the same month, we had two Radio 4 series decommissioned, essentially, and I found out that my wife was pregnant. Well, I say I found out. That makes it sound like I discovered. She told me she was pregnant. She told me she was pregnant after I'd come back from recording an episode of The Department with John on about 2 hours sleep in 3 days. And I got home and she said, "How was the recording?" I said, "Oh, it was fine." And she said, "Right, we've got to talk. I'm pregnant." So it was all within the space of a few weeks. Pretty much my whole personal and professional life was... significantly rearranged. So so I don't know what would have happened, but I hope we'd do some more things together at some point.
Without wanting you to slag off your family, I just want to talk a bit more about what that feels like, because there are... You know, I spoke to Richard Herring on this show, who talked very candidly about, obviously, the divergence between his and Stuart Lee's career and the way they're both doing, as you and John are, both doing great work in very different, not different fields exactly, but in different areas of public recognition. So.
Yeah.
And I just want to spend a minute on what that feels like, what your emotional reaction was to John suddenly going stratospheric. Oh, well, not suddenly. It's easy to see it suddenly from the outside.
It wasn't. I mean, it was clear as soon as he got the job that it was... he was going to be very successful on it. I always thought that was inevitable because, you know, he was very good and... he was very prepared for it. As I said, we'd been doing a lot of political comedy over the previous 5 years. He'd been doing it solo and we'd been doing it together. He had also quite a lot of TV experience here, so he was fully prepared for it, and he was going into a very strong, established show. So nothing that has happened since has really surprised me in terms of the success that he's had, because he sort of went into it prepared to succeed. There have been times when I guess I've been jealous of it to an extent, largely just because there's... In terms of my own career, I've had reached a bit of a frustrating plateau and haven't necessarily gone about getting beyond that plateau in the most efficient way or the best way. But at the same time, the fact that he's done so well gives me a lot of, confidence that should I ever get an opening to do a show like... or be on a show like John has been on and is currently doing, or to contribute to his show or my own show of that sort, then I will have had that same sort of training to do it, to be able to sort of hit the ground running if that happens. But, you know, it's there have been times when that seemed a very, very long way away, given the the sort of nature of topical comedy in British media, which is why doing the Bugle was a it sort of saved my career in a lot of ways, because I'd really hit a bit of a wall in both creatively and in terms of career progression, and then suddenly we were given this out of nothing, really, that our agents managed to get us a deal with the Times to do a weekly show of the sort that we'd probably have always wanted to do on radio here before John went to the States, and that then in turn built up my live audience, where now when I do live gigs I have a lot of Bugle listeners in the crowd. So I've gone off on a bit of a tangent there, but yeah, I mean there's been unquestionably times when I've found it quite difficult. Not that John's been doing well and I've wanted him to do badly, but that sort of highlighted the fact that I've hit various brick walls in terms of my own career. But at the same time, that's, you know, the fact that he's done so well gives me hope that I could do not necessarily equally well, but be, you know, have success at some point if I get or create that right opportunity.
And are you pitching shows ever? Are you going, hang on, we could do this, come on, let's wedge a topical show into British consciousness?
I've pitched a lot of shows to Radio 4. I've done a few shows. I've not really done much television here. I think I need to be a little more proactive, probably. But whether that would bear fruit or not, I don't know. But yeah, that makes me sound like I'm grumpy about the state of my
career. Not at all. Because
fundamentally, what I do for a living is I sit in my shed. I write whatever I want for a number of different outlets. I get to watch cricket and justify it as work, and I have a wife, two kids, and a shed. So fundamentally, things are great. But there are moments when, I guess, like all comedians, you always think you should be doing better than you are.
Well, this is it. This is it. And I think all of us are thinking we should do better than we are. Something Alan Cochrane's fond of describing himself as the invisible man of comedy.
Yeah.
Every person I said that to says, oh, God, I feel like that about myself. Everyone does. I just think it's thrown into particularly sharp relief when you've done a lot of work with someone. Yeah. And then, you know, whether it's their own show in the US or people go off and do movies or, you know, there's people, like, the stakes are so high now in terms of, we were all in whatever finals of whatever competitions we were in X number of years ago with people who are now millionaires.
Yes.
That's kind of, whoa, yeah, I'm happy with my own small way, my podcast has sort of given me a certain kind of, it sort of turned me into a comedy pundit somehow, right, in a way I didn't expect at all, but it's just another little element of, oh, you're that person who, as opposed to you're some guy.
Yeah, yeah.
So those things, I totally get what you're saying, in that, you know, what you've got at the moment is brilliant. Everyone is constantly, I mean, I'm very fond of imagining, whether it's true or not, that Ricky Gervais is going, what's the next thing? Now I want to be Jamie Foxx. I have, like, whatever the next thing is. What piece of your work do you feel most proud of? Like a specific bit? I mean, a specific bit?
I'm not sure there's a specific bit. In terms of the specific joke, probably the 12 fucks. In terms of I'm very proud of what we've done on the Bugle. It's been, I think, you know, we've kept pretty high standards throughout 6.5 years and 270-odd episodes. The department that we did on Radio 4, which was me and John and Chris Addison, I think was a really great show, and I still hope one day that it'll be made as a TV show, which is sort of how we envisaged it in the first place, as a sort of sitcom about fixing various bits of Britain or the world. But that, just as most radio shows do, it just disappeared in the 11 o'clock slot and was never heard again. But it was absolutely...
Was that was Radio 4?
Radio 4, yeah. We did three series of it, and it was just packed with jokes, and I think it had some very good satire in it as well, but it was... There was barely a second in it that didn't have some form of scripted or audio joke. And I'm still very proud of that. And when I listen, you know, I have it occasionally come up on my iPod on shuffle, and it still makes me laugh. So
hopefully someday that'll reach a wider audience.
This is this might go nowhere. I thought of this one on the bus on the way here. If you were going to step down from the position of Andy Zaltzman and go,
are there rumours going around? This might be imminent.
And become, I want to say, and go off to become a sort of happy beggar somewhere. I think I'm channeling some half-remembered fairy tale or in myth or something. But if you were going to be, if there was a replacement Andy Zaltzman coming in now, what would be your top tips to him? Is that the man?
Wow. Well, starting or taking over from where
he's
I am.
He's taking
now.
Over. You're handing over the keys to the shed. You and your replacements of your wife and family have turned up as well.
All right, so he's not getting the wife
he's
and
not
kids.
Getting the wife and family. You get to keep the wife and kids.
But not the shed.
But not the shed. He gets the shed.
It's going to be very difficult to deal without the shed. Now that is something I guess I would advise him to work, concentrate a little more on the career side of things rather than just the creative side of things. So I think I've tended to just be happy, you know, making the bugle and trying to sort of create the things I want to create and not really pushed myself hard enough in terms of career progress, but I don't know. I don't know really. I don't know what I'd advise. Get more sleep. Fundamentally, that's learn to work to a daylight deadline. That is something I've never ever mastered. And you probably find more people to collaborate with, probably.
Do you think that was, thanks, that's the first outing for that question. That was a really good answer. Thank you. Because I suppose what I'm getting at is, like, I know my one, I would go, it's almost like, what advice would you give yourself as a young person?
Yeah.
You know, yours is maybe, you know, focus a bit harder on your, on the career side of things. But then, part of the reason why the Bugle is so loved is it's the nature of it, that you're clearly making your best friend laugh for fun.
Yes. Yeah,
do you know what I mean? And maybe a sort of sanitised, cleaned up, career-minded version of the Bugle would be awful.
Yes, and also, you know, had I been more career-minded, I might not have been any more successful than I am. It might be just that.
That would have been a shame, wouldn't it? If you got up and done 50 press-ups every morning and it was the same.
That might just be my level. Who knows? So, I've always just concentrated on the creative side of things, and that's what I love most, is trying to make people laugh, but whether they're listening on headphones or in an audience. So.
Do you still do the Edinburgh Festival? You're doing Edinburgh
this year. I've had 2 years off, but
I've seen Helen's incredible poster.
Yes,
for this amazing work. Yeah. Do you have a strategy regarding Edinburgh? Is it a case of, I mean, what percentage? This is a good question. What percentage of your total audience capacity on an average night will be buglers?
I don't know, but a significant amount. I would think, I don't know, over half. I'd probably buy quite a lot, but I don't know. I sense that there's a significant majority, but I'm always aware not to just play to them. But yeah, like I said, it's certainly changed my stand-up audience significantly doing it.
This is something I interviewed Greg Proops for this podcast, and he was talking about the difference now in his live work, now that he has the opportunity to say what he wants to say without needing to write it into stand-up. He can just say it to the audience come to his live podcast. That you know what I mean? It's changed both things.
Yes, yeah. Definitely. And also, you know, having fans changes what you can do in stand-up.
Did you just ahem before saying fans? You did, didn't you? Yeah,
because this works on the level that I'm at, where, you know, I might have 30 buglers in an audience of 50, or, you know, on a particularly good day in Edinburgh, maybe 80 in an audience of 120. I don't know. But it obviously also works if you're a TV act and you've got 9,000 fans in an audience of 12,000 in an arena. It fundamentally changes what you set out to do as a stand-up, because you can trust
a significant proportion of your audience, and not have to sort of win them over as you do if you're if they don't know you, or they don't know much about you, or they're a bit sceptical about you. So so it's been absolutely great for my stand-up, I think, that it's I'd become a little not necessarily bored of it, but I wasn't massively enjoying it. Like I said, I was never that good at circuit stand-up, and so the Bugle gave me an audience that meant that in my stand-up I could just go out and do exactly the type of comedy that I wanted to do, and have confidence that I was attracting an audience that already was on the right wavelength. Did that answer the original question?
It totally did. It totally did. It just it ended very definitely, and I realised I didn't know what my next question was. Yes, so the original question was your strategy for Edinburgh.
I didn't answer the question at
all. Yes. No, that's okay. I digress.
Yeah, no, I don't know if I've never... this is part of my total ineptitude at managing my own career. I'm not sure I've ever had much of a strategy for Edinburgh. I initially wanted to do it to challenge, you know, to learn as a comedian, and it's just one of the things that you do as part of your... I guess apprenticeship, for want of a better word, and you sort of hope that you'll get noticed. But then after a few years, I just did it because I love doing it, and as a way of continuing to develop new material and try and evolve and improve as a comedian. In terms of writing the show, I've tended to be quite haphazard about it. Like I say, I tend to work quite tight to deadlines. The problem with a live show is that deadline is slightly flexible, that you can always carry on working on a show, even a show that you've done 100 times. You can find new ways of doing things. So I'm not sure I have an Edinburgh strategy other than during the festival I try and put a new joke in every day.
Okay. Just
so there's a bit of the show that I'm really looking forward to doing, and I think that can help maintain the freshness of the rest of it.
It's interesting, isn't it, the way that people approach Edinburgh, because so many of us feel like there's a ladder. You start off as an open spot, then you're in the middle, then you're, you know, you feel like, there is the future laid out in front of me. Now I go to Edinburgh, now I go to Edinburgh again, now I go to Edinburgh again, and then often people go, well, do I just keep doing this now?
Yes.
You know what I mean? You sort of lose...
Yes, I think... I think I probably lost that quite early. My first solo show, so I did the Comedy Zone in 2000, late night 4-person stand-up package show, and I really struggled, learnt a lot, went back the following year, did my first solo show, which I really loved doing, and I think it was, you know, for a first show, pretty good. It got good reviews, almost no audiences. I got nominated for the newcomer at the end, but that was in those days just announced at the ceremony, so you didn't even get 3 days of increased sales.
And then they're increased sales that hate you. They're just there because they got nominated. Yeah, this is everyone's complaint. Just there because you got nominated.
I rather cockily thought the following year.
Okay.
I thought, yeah, that's gonna guarantee me a crowd the next year. And I went up, and I was still only doing a 55 seat room was Pleasant Over the Road too in those days, I thought, well, that's, you know, that I struggled last year. I mean, I was playing to really pitifully small audiences, but that now I've got that Edinburgh accolade, that's gonna buy me a crowd essentially. And I was playing to slightly larger small crowds than I had the year before, and I thought, well, you know, it's it doesn't make that much difference. There's some acts who just get a bit of zeitgeist and it does work for them, but there's no point sort of pursuing that. And I just from then on just tried to do the show that I most wanted to do, and was probably a bit passive about it from a kind of career strategy point of view, but I always loved doing it and always managed to not go mad during Edinburgh and enjoy doing the show and not get fussed about reviews or whether someone was coming in who might get me a guest slot on a panel show about home improvements or whatever. So,
do you feel like an outsider? That's, you mentioned about, you know, doing panel shows. I know you've done bits and bobs, but do you feel that, you mentioned as well the closed shop of Radio 4 in terms of writing on other things. Do you feel that you sort of exist? Do you feel like a bit of a weirdo, a bit of an outsider to the industry? Or
I don't know. I don't think it's a close shop in terms of writing on shows. It was more that they're not really looking for new topical shows. So if you wanted to get a version of the Now show off the ground now, it would be very difficult, I think, because they're simply actively not looking for it. And in terms of an outsider, I don't know. I mean, I'm not panel show fodder. I've done a couple and I was not very good at them. I think I'd probably be a bit better at it if I did it now, but it's not something that I'm particularly fussed about. You know, I've never been on Mock the Week, but I don't know if I'd be any good on it at all. And if they were ever going to ask, they'd have asked at some point in the last 10 years. So it's not something that's worth getting worried about or caring about. I don't know, to an extent. But at the same time, I've always had plenty going on in my career. So it's not like I've been sitting at home doing nothing. I've always had, particularly since the Bugle started, a lot of deadlines, a lot of things to work on that I've really loved doing. Which is better than having a slightly nebulous goal of wanting to do something that you don't particularly want to do in order to get to do something else that you might not want to do as well. So.
Yes, this reminds me of what Sarah Pascoe said to me in 50 episodes ago. She sort of said words to the effect that you end up with the career that you want. Because you actually, what you are, you get to do all of these things that you like doing. What you like doing is writing and working on stuff and having the time to do that, or maybe, you know, watching the time fly away whilst trying to do that. What I want to do, even though I don't like to admit that I want to do it, is I quite like doing circuit gigs. I quite like the variety. I quite like it that one day I feel amazing and the next day I feel awful. I don't know if I like that in a healthy way, but I'm attracted to it somehow and it ends up being what happens.
Though I think there's an element of that. Obviously, some people get good breaks, others don't. Some people take those breaks, others maybe don't. So it's...
Do you think it's a meritocracy? A lot of my guests go, oh, great thing about comedy is it's a meritocracy.
There's elements of meritocracy about it. And, you know, when you start off as a stand-up, if you make people laugh, you'll get booked back for gigs. If you do panel shows and people like you on them, whether it's audience or commissioners, you'll get asked back. There is an element of it, but at the same time, you do need a bit of a break. You need to be the right type of sometimes you need to be the right type of act at the right time. It's not a strict meritocracy, certainly, but you know, at the same time, if you make enough people laugh, then I guess you'll generally find something to do.
And finally, what would be your final message? What would be on your gravestone? What, you know what I mean? As a message to the comedy world. No. Let's take the idea of... Sorry, in this conversation, you've been replaced with some sort of automaton and then killed. I suppose what I'm asking is, what would you say to new comedians? As a less interesting way of asking the same question. What is the sort of one or two defining principles that you'd say, I see people making this mistake over and over again, do this?
I'm not sure I'm in any position to advise new comedians. It very much depends what they want from a career in comedy. Do they want commercial and career success, or do they want to be the best comedian that they can be? The two aren't mutually exclusive, but there are different ways of going about getting each of them. I would generally say do not be afraid of failure, learn to embrace it to an extent, and be creatively ambitious and take risks in terms of what type of comedy you're doing. Don't be afraid if something bombs. But I don't know in terms of constructing a career. But like I said earlier on, I think that the best comedy comes from a certain amount of honesty in terms of why you're doing it. So I guess roughly that was pretty badly expressed.
It's not going to fit on a gravestone, Andy.
That's not going to fit on a gravestone. If I had to choose anything to do on my gravestone, it'd probably be I digress. So in fact, that's another thing I riffed out on a gig the other day, the idea that you should carry a gravestone
around with you at all times and just chisel on it through your life to make you sort of analyse how things are going. the self-updating gravestone. That's carry a gravestone with you at all times and make notes on it after every gig. Notes that you cannot forget.
Thanks, man.
Pleasure. Cheers.
So that was Andy, and I didn't even manage halfway through the interview. I remembered at the end, or at some point during this interview, I want to say the phrase, boom, Andy. But I didn't. I completely forgot. And I mean, I frequently say that to my girlfriend even, so it would have been nice to say it as Altman. He was absolutely brilliant, wasn't he? I mean, I'm assuming you're all conversant with the Bugle podcast. Obviously, if you're not before, you don't know what the hell we're talking about. It's absolutely fantastic, so do give it a try. And it's starting to feel like, I mean, it's been going for years. It's starting to feel like it's one of those institutions like I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue or something. It's got so many in-jokes and references and tropes. It really feels like a family, and it keeps me company and makes me laugh a very great deal. Thank you to Olivia Phipps for some help with the podmin for this episode. This episode was not, incidentally, co-produced by Nathan Wood, because he's been busy doing World Cup things. I did it all myself, which is why, no doubt, it doesn't sound as good. Ha! Back next week with Armin Rahman. By the time you hear this, I will be at Glastonbury Festival, so if you're listening on your way to Glastonbury, come and see me MC the cabaret tent at lunchtime on Friday, or doing a set there around 6 p.m, 6:30 on Saturday, or I will see you all smashed up in the rabbit hole. That sounds like an awful sentence. It was meant to sound like a sort of enticing, hey, I see you, let's get all smashed up in the rabbit hole. I think let's get takes the edge off it. This has gone on far too long. Bye for now. Armin Rahman, next week. I've recorded that already. Absolutely fantastic. He's brilliant. Prepare yourself for next week's podcast by watching Search for any of his stuff on YouTube. It's AAMERRAHMAN. This is nice. I'm setting you homework. But the biggest, most successful clip, and one that we'll be talking about a little bit in that interview, is Reverse Racism. If you search Reverse Racism on YouTube, you will see a very funny unpacking and total destruction of that concept by Armin Rahman. Watch that. Then you'll know what we're talking about next week. That's everything. Okay, bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.